Hello, and welcome to Merely Catholic, the Catholic Herald's podcast. I'm Gavin Ashington. Today we go to Jerusalem to talk to Father Dwight Longenecker, an American Catholic priest and an author who's been on pilgrimage there over Easter. Father Dwight's own journey into Catholicism took him from evangelical Protestant Anglicanism, where he spent some time as a vicar on the Isle of Wight, to the Catholic priesthood in his native America. He is a well-read, in both senses, and a compelling author. And since this has become a measure of social traction, it's worth saying he's also accumulated over 44,000 followers on Twitter, which may even qualify him as an influencer. The journey from the heart of Europe to Jerusalem, where Father Dwight is speaking to us from, is over 2,000 miles, and it used to take pilgrims about 70 days, or 2.5 months, to walk and sail there. Flying and the internet make distances immeasurably closer, but whilst they shrink the geography, they do nothing to shrink the intensity of the meaning of this important place. Time may still elude our meddling, but space has become wondrously accessible, and Jerusalem as a place remains the centre of the world for many Christian pilgrims, as much as it did for medieval cartographers. In our conversation, whilst we begin with the geography of personal pilgrimage, and then move swiftly on to the metaphysics of the Church's pilgrimage, we also look at the culture wars. Father Dwight sums up the conflict between the Church and the world today as being usefully reduced to coming down to different perceptions of sex and the supernatural. Sex has been preoccupying secular society in an increasingly overt way ever since Sigmund Freud gave it a privileged platform all of its own. Supernatural, on the other hand, over the same time period, has been under attack ever since the measuring of material things became the touchstone for all reality instead of just some reality. Faith, hope, and love have never been accessible to empirical measurement, and the Catholic Church more than any other body has been formed and informed by encounters with the miraculous. The Church is inevitably always engaged in a struggle with the culture it lives within. The Gospels talk about being in the world, but not of the world. And this distinction means that the Church sets out to challenge, confront, turn and heal the world without being subverted herself, without surrendering her own integrity for favours or protection from the status quo or prosperity within it. And that challenge is crystallised into two different expressions of the Catholic Church today. Both, confusingly, are driven by compassion. One believes that to be truly compassionate is to be informed by the secular notions of progress, and thus accommodating and even amplifying sexual desire and identity, and courting scientific sympathy by diminishing the supernatural. And the other expresses compassion by containing in order to transform the sexual instinct, and by testing but also celebrating the supernatural. Father Dwight compares these two expressions of Catholicism, and he casts a comparative eye over the British and the American Catholic scenes, and weighs up what, in his opinion, is at stake in the culture wars. Father Dwight Longenecker in Jerusalem. Welcome. What an amazing thing it is that you can be in Jerusalem and I can be elsewhere and we can talk like this. Technology is truly wondrous.
Yeah, someone needs to write an article about how the internet has improved the universality of the Church.
It certainly has. Tell me, first of all, you've been in Jerusalem for Holy Week. I remember once when I was on a pilgrimage, I know that Jerusalem was razed to the ground, and what we have now is a reconstruction of various things, although there are some sites embedded in the earth which haven't changed at all. I found myself having to take my shoes off as I walked the Via Dolorosa because I couldn't do otherwise. How have you found being in Jerusalem in Holy Week?
Just wonderful. You really are aware when you are here that our faith is built around the incarnation, which is the enfleshment of God in the human world, in human history. And here in this city where history is, you know, just woven into every rock and stone, and history that goes back, of course, thousands and thousands of years, you're just caught up in this, and it's really very moving.
Theologically, it is astonishing, isn't it? Because matter must matter if the place matters so much. To be there and to feel, you have a sense when our Lord said, if you were to keep quiet, the very rocks would cry out. The rocks, the stones, they have a purpose of witness, almost of martyrdom.
And Jerusalem is a city made of stone. Everywhere you walk, there are stone pavements, stone walls, this beautiful golden limestone, which is just everywhere. And so, yes, the rocks and stones cry out time and time again as you walk around Jerusalem. You know, I wrote someplace about incarnation, saying that for anything to be real, it has to become particular. music. The composer might have music in his head, but he needs to write it down on a real piece of paper with a real pen so that eventually real fingers will play real ivory keys, which hit real chords with a real hammer to make a real sound, which is heard in real ears. In other words, it needs to become incarnate to become real. And likewise, God becomes real through these rocks and stones.
How did you find the liturgies over Holy Week?
Well, the Latin Patriarch, which is essentially the Catholic Archbishop in the Middle East, is based here in Jerusalem. I was here for Holy Week, and of course, he celebrates all of the liturgies in Latin, because that is our shared language out here. When you look around at the liturgies in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and elsewhere, you see, of course, little nuns from the Philippines and African Franciscans and people from all over the globe who you're sharing the Christian faith with. And it's just so exhilarating and exciting. And of course, then you have to throw into that all of the ancient liturgies and ancient rites who are gathered together here in Jerusalem, the Greek Orthodox, the Greek Catholics, the Armenians, the Armenian Catholics, the Ethiopians. They're all there in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. They're all here gathered in Jerusalem. So over the last few Sundays, I've actually been absenting myself from the religious community where I'm staying and attending some of the different Eastern liturgies. On Sunday, just 2 days ago, I had the remarkable experience of going to the Syriac Catholic liturgy. Only about 30 people there, because it's a very small one of the Eastern rites in communion with the Holy See. But my goodness, they did make a joyful noise. The liturgy was full of these Middle Eastern voices bellowing out the liturgy, these beautiful prayers in the Eastern rite. There was another element added to the joy, which was next to me was a young woman with two children. The boy was dressed as a Jew with the yarmulke, the little skull cap, and the prayer tassels hanging down. So I asked her afterwards. She said, well, she was a convert from Judaism, Orthodox Jewry, and a fellow American. So what an amazing experience to meet her.
Incredible. It always seemed to me that the times I've been to Jerusalem, that it's a place in permanent crisis with so many tensions, political, spiritual, and cultural. However apocalyptically sensitized one's become, the sense of crisis seems to have spread beyond Jerusalem into our own cultures. How do you compare the state of Catholicism in the United Kingdom as you came to know it and with America? Because you've straddled both places and you've got a clear sense over the last 20 or 30 years about the trajectory of things.
Yeah, remember, I haven't lived in the UK for nearly 15 years. Well, over 15 years. We moved back to the States in 2006. So, of course, I'm not completely up to speed with the state of affairs in England and in the Catholic Church in England. But from what I can pick up reading through the lines and staying in touch with friends, there's a real crisis there in many ways. And it was exacerbated by the pandemic, which, of course, the church seemed to take a real hit. I know that my English friends are concerned about the state of the church, the Catholic Church in England, wondering whether it's going to bounce back and how it's going to bounce back.
And how does that compare with the States? Did they close the doors in the same way we did over here?
Well, in the US, the Catholic environment is even more divided. There seems to be two churches in the US. There is the established Catholic Church, which dominates the hierarchy and dominates the old established, for us old, established Catholic colleges and universities. It's safe to say that that sort of establishment Catholic Church in America is, like most establishments, rather hidebound and conforming to the ideologies of the world, conforming to the establishment of the world, conforming to the some of the woke ideologies that are about us at the moment. But there is another Catholic Church in America, which is, I hate to use the words conservative and liberal, but it is more conservative, but it's very energetic, very entrepreneurial. This is the church of an awful lot of lay people who are simply getting up out of the pews and they're doing church. They're starting radio stations, they're starting schools, they're starting colleges, they're starting publishing houses, they're starting podcasts and videos. They're out there doing what Vatican II suggested that we do, that is the laity of the church coming alive, rolling up their sleeves and doing what they can with what they have where they are. And I find it terribly exciting. For instance, most dioceses in America have a diocesan men's conference, which is organized by laymen for laymen. They have a budget, they have a website, they bring in well-known speakers, all of whom expect a realistic speaker's fee. They fly them in, they put them up. they sell tickets, and some of these men's conferences can draw, you know, 1,500, 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 guys for a Saturday, exploring their faith, hearing great speakers, and being energized to go back and live the Catholic faith. And this kind of lay involvement in the Catholic Church in America is befuddling to some members of that establishment church. They don't really like it. In fact, they don't even know that it's going on. But it is going on, and it's also networked into the home school movement and into the parish school movement. The new seminarians who are coming through are by and large from this other church that I'm talking about, this Church of the Laity, the church that is energetic and entrepreneurial. I found a place within that church and still sit rather uncomfortably among my fellow clergy in this what I call the established church. And that may be why I didn't find such a happy home in the Anglican church when I was in England also, that I have a kind of contrariness built into me, I'm afraid.
Well, I think it's built into the gospel. There's always a sense of creative tension between things as they are and things as they ought to be. And those who are too lined up defending the status quo and things as they are sometimes find the vision of things as they ought to be a bit difficult. I've been very interested in the way in which I hear voices, trad voices, being cross with Pope Francis and being cross with the whole of Vatican II. And I see, as you've just described, the establishment. But there's a middle ground, isn't there? It's one you seem to inhabit, but I certainly in the UK, I don't see a lot of this middle ground where you haven't opted for either a politicized or an over-spiritualized view of the church. And yet you've written two really very insightful books about spiritual warfare. Can you explain this middle ground that you inhabit?
Well, I don't see it as a middle ground. You know, my background is as an evangelical Protestant, then coming up through Anglicanism and Anglo-Catholicism to finally step into the Catholic Church. So many of these so-called divisions in the church, I see them as being artificial and man-made. All I have ever tried to do myself in my writing and in my life is to follow what C.S. Lewis called mere Christianity. For me, mere Christianity became more Christianity in the Catholic faith. It's simply being faithful to the gospel. And we were talking about belonging to the establishment or not. I can remember one of the little sort of bon mots that I picked up over the years was that the gospel is only good news when it's subversive. In other words, as you stated, there's this kind of subversiveness to the gospel, which is good news. It means that the establishment ways of the world are undermined by the good news of the gospel. And it is that kind of spirit and that kind of mentality which has always driven me forward, my spirituality and whatever I've tried to do for this, for the church.
Rowan Wade has seemed to, the prospect of it being overthrown has energized progressives into a deeper antipathy towards Catholicism, which they see as being the emblematic opposition to abortion. We've been watching American campuses experience the onslaught of Black Lives Matter, and the culture wars in America seem to be more developed there than anywhere else. What do you see happening as this, what appears to be a great division, develops in Western society? Everything seems to happen in America first. What's the relationship going to be between Catholics and the heart of wokery in the States?
Yeah, I think there's going to be a continued acceleration of this division in American culture between not just Catholics and the woke ideologies, but also all historic Christians, those who believe the gospel, those who believe in the historical documents of the church, those who, whether they're Catholic or Orthodox or conservative Protestants, see the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ as being the foundation of Western culture, trying to hold to that, and those who would see it as something that needs to be destroyed and undermined and rejected. And I think that animosity is going to continue and will reach a flashpoint eventually where I don't like to be paranoid or alarmist about it, but I would not at all be surprised if there is some sort of institutionalized persecution of Christians within our lifetime.
We were talking to Cardinal Pell a few weeks ago, which was a great conversation, and I asked him what his view was on Pope Benedict, Cardinal Ratzinger, as he was then, vision of a church stripped and shorn down of its power, but consisting of a more muscular and holier community. And he said rather laconically, "I don't believe in German minimalism." I guess he was saying he wants the Catholic Church to aim at being wholly and utterly embedded in the political and cultural instincts of a country. How do you see it playing out?
One of the things I see emerging is the church in the developing world. My friend John Allen wrote a book in 2009 called Future Church, which is actually very enlightening because it's now, you know, over 10 years into his predictions. And he looked at the demographics and the economics and all of those kind of factors which play into the future complexion of the Catholic Church. And it is overwhelmingly true that the future of the Catholic Church will be from the South and from the East. It'll be Asian and African. It will be deeply rooted in the supernatural. It'll be deeply rooted also in traditional morality. But Allen also points out that for those who tend to be conservative economically, in other words, capitalists, that the African and the Asian churches coming from the poor world may also very validly challenge the sort of supremacy of American capitalistic colonialism, and that they will undermine this in a way which is consistent with Catholic social teaching and therefore bring their own gifts to the development of what we would call Christian culture.
You used a very interesting phrase a moment ago, sex and the supernatural. It sounds like a title for a good book, I think. It seems to me that the church of the last 50 years has been profoundly mistaken about both, in the sense that it's been embarrassed to talk in a highly sexualized culture about sexual continence and about the call to holiness involving the constraint of appetites rather than the feeding of them. And the whole 20th century mindset, battered as it's been by Enlightenment atheists, has rather given up on the supernatural than miraculous. I mean, one of the reasons I became a Catholic was because I saw the Catholic Church as holding the ground, keeping a witness, and being the greatest exponent of a proper Christian articulation, both about sex and the supernatural. But they're highly contested areas.
Every culture down through history, Christian or not, has had logical and sensible restraints on human sexuality. It doesn't matter what culture you go to, the most primitive or the most sophisticated culture, pagan or Christian. To put it simply, they've had rules about marriage. They've had rules about who you could sleep with. They've had rules about what you can do with your genitalia. Any society that's had total free license has actually ended up in massive male supremacy, because basically the only morality you have left when you get rid of Christian morality is the morality of force, which is, I'm bigger than you, I'm stronger than you, I will do to you what I want to do because I have more muscle than you. And in sexuality, this leads, of course, to male supremacy. When you read Tom Holland's books about ancient Rome, he says, the sexual morality of ancient Rome was basically, if you were a male citizen, to put it bluntly, you could basically rape anybody. Women, children, slaves, they were yours for the taking because you could. That is the sort of sexual world we will be moving into when we forsake Christian morality.
I've been astonished at my own change of views as I grew up through the 50s and 60s, and I began to look at the Catholic Church through secular eyes, as I was trained to do, and see it as repressed and utterly impractical, and probably with the Freudian critique of, if you repress things, then it'll cause you trouble elsewhere. One of the things that's happened at the end of my life is I've taken a complete opposite view now. I see only the Catholic Church as having any sense of sexual continence at all. And that's, I think, one of its most powerful strengths, as the culture war dissolves all the bonds that holds society together. Feminists are very angry with the Catholic Church, as we've seen in the Roe and Wade debate, but there doesn't seem to be yet a sense that they're destroying themselves.
No, it's reduced to absolute madness, any lack of rationality in the arguments that are being put forward. They're totally emotional. This is the other thing which evaporates, of course, with the erosion of Christian morality, is the erosion of faith and reason. My book, Beheading Hydra, I've analyzed 16 different isms that are destroying Western society. And one of them is sentimentalism, in which we revert to making all of our decisions, moral decisions, relationship decisions, economic decisions, political decisions, based on our feelings and our feelings alone. Now, I'm not opposed to the heart. I'm not saying we should be all head, but neither should we be all heart. Because once we lapse back into sentimentalism, we tend to think only of the nice sentiments, the sweet tenderness, the kindness, and so forth. But of course, there are other emotions as well, the emotions of rage, emotions of resentment, emotions of which lead to violence. And once we give in to sentimentality, we will eventually move away from tenderness towards rage and violence, which is what we're seeing in the pro-life debate at the moment.
The whole area of supernaturals also affected people. I remember once I had a BBC radio program and I interviewed my local Catholic bishop. This would have been about 2008, I think. And after the program, we sat down, had a cup of coffee together. And I said, I had just discovered Mary and the apparitions. And I was bowled over by Gabon Dal and Fatima. And the bishop was about to take a diocesan pilgrimage to Lourdes. And I said to him, rather ineptly, as one does when you're making small conversation, "Blessed are you. How lucky are you as a bishop to have Lourdes as part of your church's experience. And you must be very excited about going there and the implications." And he looked at me and said, "Well, of course, I don't actually believe Mary appeared there." And I said, "Excuse me?" "No," he said, "you know, then I don't put words in his mouth." But the answer was, he took a reductionist and materialist view. And as far as he was concerned, Lourdes provided the diocese for a nice, happy get together, an excuse to go to France. I was absolutely astonished that I should have been talking to a Catholic bishop who didn't have any sense of the supernatural.
Welcome to the modern Catholic Church. And that was my experience. I'm afraid of the Catholic Church in England, of bishops who were occupying their places, who were, well, I hate to be too denigrating about them, but they seemed to me to be social workers in red robes. They were taking the usual, as you say, reductionist, materialistic view about the faith. They didn't seem to have much more belief in the supernatural religion that I was following than many of the Anglican bishops that I'd spoken to, an Anglican clergy.
Yes, we should say the Anglicans were at least as bad, maybe worse. But you've written two very, very powerful books, Immortal Combat and Beheading Hydra, where you draw on the depths of the Catholic spiritual tradition in order to give people teaching and information and understanding about the spiritual fight. How do you see the conversation within Catholicism between these two positions? I heard someone say, well, this materialism, it's just the kind of the Vatican II generation. They're all going to die out shortly. They don't produce new Christians. They can't replicate their own culture. True, supernatural, miraculous, energetic Catholicism will reemerge from the ruins of the late 20th century. It certainly seems to in terms of the way you've been writing.
Well, I can remember once when I was in the Anglican Church, hearing the frustrations of a bishop who had come back from one of these international Anglican bishops' conferences. And this man was a good man who believed in the supernatural claims of the gospel and the Christian church. He explained his experience of trying to dialogue with one of the materialists, modernist materialists. He says, "You know, it was like trying to play tennis on two adjacent courts." In other words, there was no dialogue, you know, there was no game. It wasn't going on at all because the underlying assumptions, the underlying presuppositions were totally different. So my response to you would be, yes, I think that it's the same in the Catholic Church at the moment. There is no dialogue between these two groups because we believe in the historic supernatural faith, which is the Christian religion. And what frustrates me so completely about this, and which I keep ranting on about, is if it's not supernatural, it's not only not Christianity, it's not even a religion, because religion is the dealings of humanity with the supernatural realm. No matter what religion it is, whether it's the Aztecs or it's the Anglicans, religion is about the supernatural. So if you make it totally materialistic, it's not only not Catholicism and not Christianity, it ain't even a religion.
Finally, are you finding a flow of people coming into the Catholic Church? We hear there aren't enough ordinations. There's a diocese of Chicago is ordaining nobody this year. There's a fear, as we've talked about, that Catholicism is shredding members. Fewer and fewer are practicing. But my experience is that, as well as that being true, there's really something of a gravitational draw back in to the Mother Church. That's my internet experience. It's local and personalized and tiny.
I'm convinced that a huge number of people are hungry and thirsty for exactly what the Catholic Church should be, which is a supernatural, living, historic Christian faith with the resurrected Lord at the very heart of it all, with the power of the gospel and the power of the Holy Spirit flowing through the church in a vibrant and dynamic and living way. And that huge numbers of people are desperate for the church to be like that, and they would join the church tomorrow if the church was really what the church should be. But we too often are scared to proclaim the gospel. We're frightened to actually live that faith, and we're frightened that we might be embarrassed by our supernaturalism, when in fact, the world is hungry for it. Just look around you at the proliferation of the supernatural within popular culture. with superheroes and supernatural horror stories and horror movies and discussions of exorcism and all this kind of stuff and black magic. People are hungry for the supernatural, but if the church doesn't give them the supernatural through the Holy Spirit, they'll search for it elsewhere.
How much longer have you got in Jerusalem before you return home?
Well, I'm here to the end of May, and then I'll be coming to England for 20 days to lead a pilgrimage with some fellow Americans to some of the English holy places, and then returning to the States in the middle of June.
Wonderful. Have a wonderful trip. Father Dwight Longenecker from Jerusalem, thank you so much for the conversation. Thank you for joining us, and God bless your travels and your work.